This archived broadcast of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, there is no doubt that in establishing our great constitutional republic, our founding fathers well understood both the heights and the depths of human nature. In fact, James Madison, the father of our Constitution, once wrote the following: "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." But over the course of history and human nature, our natural sinful depravity has had a way of eventually leading to the decline and the demise of multiple empires that once were thought to be indestructible. And given our moral decadence and massive debt, is the decline and demise of America also possible and maybe even closer than we think? Well, we're going to talk about that today with nationally syndicated columnist and author Cal Thomas. His new book is called America's Expiration Date, The Fall of Empires and Superpowers and the Future of the United States. Cal, it's great to have you with us today. How are you?
Thank you, Janet. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. You say that America is in danger of losing its greatness. Explain why you think that is.
Well, this book, Janet, was inspired by an essay written by the late British diplomat Sir John Glubb, who studied 4,000 years of human history and found that there was a pattern to the decline of empires and great nations, and that it had not changed. Now, he said the average age of these great nations or empires is 250 years, and on July 4, 2026, the United States will be 250 years old. Now, I'm not running around with a sandwich board saying the end is near, but I am saying that even with the tremendous economic prosperity and military might that the United States enjoys, particularly during the Trump administration, there are some underlying foundational cracks that need to be addressed. And Sir John Glubb found that the last stage before the collapse of any of these great nations was decadence, which you just mentioned, and he defined as massive national debt. We have a $23 trillion debt, and neither party wants to do anything about it. Immigration without assimilation, and we have that as a major problem. In the past, most people wanted to become fully Americans. Now we're hyphenated Americans. A loss of a moral sense, a shared moral values, and we have that in our age of anything goes. And then a loss of a sense of God and the transcendent. And the Pew Research Center has found that 20% of millennials, when asked if they have a religious preference, say none. So all of these, I think, are contributors to the cracks in the foundation. As the psalmist said, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do?
Oh, man, that's, you're only talking 6 years from now, though. That's awfully close to be at the 250-year mark when we look at human history.
Well, it's an average, Janet, and I'm not one of these predictors. The end is near. You have all these people in the past who said the world was going to end on a certain period. But even Abraham Lincoln famously said that if the United States were to be destroyed, it will not be from an invading army. We will destroy ourselves from within.
Right.
And you look at this, 60 million abortions, you know, the mainstreaming of human relationships that just a couple of generations ago were viewed as an abomination. Cole Porter wrote a satirical song in the 1930s called Anything Goes. Well, that could become our epitaph.
You're right. You're totally right about that. So these stages that Glubb talked about, I think, are very significant. These stages that these empires have gone through that were once great and then they led to, you know, complete decline at the end. What about those stages? How important are those stages when you're looking through those and looking at our country? Have we gone through those same six stages, would you say, that Glubb mentions?
Yeah, well, I think in many ways we have. Now, we have not, as a country, been a conquering empire. I mean, we went to Europe twice in World War One and Two. We didn't seize those countries. We withdrew. All of these other foreign adventures, whether they were right or not in retrospect, we always withdrew. We were not, we being the United States, were not interested in dominating other territories as the Rome Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Russian Empire, and the other ones that I profile in here were, and the overreach was part of their problem. So not every country or superpower follows the exact pattern in the exact way, but they all wound up on the ash heap of history, particularly because all of them embrace the decadence chapter in their histories, and I think we're on the verge of that now. You know, I don't necessarily predict the country is going to come to an end on July 4, 2026, but you know, Reagan used to say we're only one generation away from losing it all, and I think we've been living off the inertia of the World War II greatest generation for too long. We need to renew these values and virtues, or like a library book, they expire.
Oh yeah, I mean, you look at some of the things that have happened recently in the news that point that out, and we could go to all sorts of different issues, not only abortion on demand, but the breakdown of the family and so forth. But there was this professor, as we know, I'm sorry, a columnist at the Denver Post who lost his job recently for saying that there are only two sexes, and I guess defying the AP style book. This is so insane. And people, I think, are beginning to really wake up and say, in some quarters at least, how do we reverse this? It's like we've lost our minds. It's not just the sexual revolution and the breakdown of the family, but we're going nuts as a country if we're buying into this stuff.
Well, you're right, Janet. I think, and as I suggest in the book, that we have to start with the young people. I mean, we don't send our military troops to enemy camps to be trained, but we, too many of us who are followers of Jesus of Nazareth, send our kids into these government schools and to universities, which dissect and deplete their faith, their values, the things their parents have taught them. So I think we need to pull our kids out of these government schools and either homeschool them or put them in good private and Christian schools where they will reinforce what we believe. I mean, I find it extraordinary that so many people I meet have no problem putting their kids in these schools where they teach them evolution, where they, you know, the school nurse gives them abortion advice and birth control materials without their parents' knowledge, where history is being rewritten because those evil white slave owners that founded America were terrible people, and all of this stuff, and we expect them to emerge from that believing what we believe, right. It's crazy. It's right. Like having a healthy breakfast and eating lead paint for lunch. You're working against yourself.
No, that's well said. Well, and what about the money issue? You mentioned the $23 trillion debt. I know we have all these unfunded liabilities as well. And you see on the left, they just want to have more and more and more giveaways of money and, you know, single payer health insurance. And Elizabeth Warren wants everybody to get, you know, money for college. And Bernie wants people to get money. I mean, it doesn't even really seem to matter to a lot of these politicians if the money is there. And yet, where does that lead eventually? There has to be a tipping point where you just can't do it anymore.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, you mentioned James Madison, the founders. You go back to the Federalist Papers, you read, they wanted limited government so the people could be unlimited. My view is that government ought to be a last resort, not a first resource.
Good.
That's what the founders wanted. And you know, we're going to change our initials if we keep going this way from USA to ATM. the politicians don't want to tell anybody no because they fear loss of votes. And as long as it's about them, and that's why we need term limits, by the way, as long as it's about them and their careers, we're not going to see anything different. Everybody, the great tragedy is everybody knows what needs to be done to fix this, particularly entitlement reform, but they don't want to do it for fear of being demagogued.
Yep.
You may remember when Paul Ryan was House Speaker, he actually came up with a serious proposal to reform Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It wasn't perfect, but it was a good first start. And the left came up with this ad with a Paul Ryan lookalike actor pushing Granny in a wheelchair over a cliff.
Yes.
Now, that's not a serious response to a serious proposal, but that's why nothing gets done in Washington.
Well, it is. Nobody wants to be seen as heartless. And you know, they don't want anybody making an ad like them, and then they're voted out of office. But the fact of the matter is, how do we remain free when we're in so much debt? I mean, doesn't that also affect our liberty long term?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at your credit cards, I mean, if you behaved like the federal government behaves, you'd be bankrupt overnight. They would cancel your cards because you couldn't even afford the interest rate. The interest rate on the national debt, Janet, is more than the gross domestic product of most nations. You think about that. But what the politicians have adopted, and too many Americans now have adopted, is this old song, I think, from the 70s, let the devil take tomorrow, help me make it through the night. So as long as I'm getting my checks, as long as I'm getting my entitlements, and those evil billionaire types, you know, it's not fair that they're making so much, and we're going to tax and regulate them, then it's okay with me. I think we need to wake up. I mean, this is serious stuff, and this is why I wrote the book.
Totally right. Cal Thomas, we're going to pause for a break. We'll come back discussing his book, America's Expiration Date. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. The healthcare open enrollment period has ended. Did you miss it? Don't go a whole year without having a healthcare program. Sign up with Liberty HealthShare. As a Christian healthcare sharing ministry, Liberty HealthShare is not insurance, so you can still sign up. In fact, you can sign up any time of year, and there are no contracts. Starting as low as $199 a month, Liberty HealthShare has memberships for singles, couples, and families, so you can choose the ideal program for your situation. Plus, Liberty HealthShare has no network, so you're free to pick your own doctors, hospitals, and providers. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit ministry, so your money goes toward helping other members with their eligible medical expenses. And in your time of need, other members are there for you, too. You can feel good knowing you're part of a community of like-minded individuals who understand the importance of people coming together to bear one another's burdens. Go to libertyhealthshare.org/JMT for more information. libertyhealthshare.org/JMT. How much is one life worth? Most of us would say life is priceless, and we'd be right. After all, what is the value of someone created in the image of God? We're asking Janet Mefford Today listeners, just like you, to help us save babies through the ministry of Preborn. How does Preborn save babies? Through ultrasounds. Preborn works with hundreds of pro-life pregnancy centers across America, providing free ultrasounds for women in crisis pregnancies. And 80% of the time, when a mother sees her little baby on an ultrasound, she'll choose life. It's that easy. We need your help to support the vital work of Preborn in saving human lives. For your gift of $28, you can provide a free ultrasound to a mom in a crisis pregnancy. And for a gift of $140, you can provide 5 ultrasounds to 5 mothers. All you have to do is call 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for saving a baby's life.
You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's Janet.
Welcome back. Great to have you with us. And great to have with us nationally syndicated columnist and author Cal Thomas. His new book is called America's Expiration Date, The Fall of Empires and Superpowers and the Future of the United States. You can't get away from history and you can't get away from human nature. And when we look back, as you've mentioned, Cal, at the work of Sir John Glaub, a lot of people don't know about him, but he had some very good things to say in The Fate of Empires and Search for Survival about the length of time that greatness lasted for some of these empires of the past. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of these empires. For example, we all know about the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire. A lot of people like to compare the Roman Empire to the modern United States. What sorts of parallels do you see, if any, when we look back at Rome and look at our situation today?
Well, there's a lot of licentiousness. So you talk about Rome had a place that a lot of the elites went, and I compared it to the Las Vegas of our day, and there were baths there, and there was commingling, and there were all kinds of other things that we shouldn't be talking about on a family-oriented program, but a loss of a moral sense, a loss of a sense of right and wrong is fundamental to the foundational principles of any nation. We talk about economic power, the president talks about the greatest military in the world, all of that's true, of course, but if you lose a sense of who you are, and more importantly, if you lose a sense of the transcendent, then you're just existing. You're just eating, drinking, and being merry, for tomorrow you die. The United States was founded on certain moral and godly principles, a sense we were a nation that Eisenhower added under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. If we lose that purpose and we are only interested in making money and buying stuff, then I think we've lost something very significant and put ourselves at risk for our own self-destruction.
Right, I agree. Are there any examples in history that Glaub mentions or that you know of that ever were able to survive their sexual revolutions and the decline into decadence?
No. And that's, you know, if you look at Scripture, all of these things precede all of us and John Glubb and everybody else, Ecclesiastes, the Proverbs, some of the Psalms, all of these things were written to warn us of what happens if we live only unto ourselves and try to appeal to our lower nature. Yeah. There literally is nothing new under the sun, but so often we behave as if we are the first generation ever to exist. We just crawled out of a cave, we have to invent the wheel, we have to discover the use of fire. But all of these things were written to teach us, John writes elsewhere. But if we won't listen and if we won't learn, then we risk heading down the same road that all of these other empires headed down. And this, you know, I wrote this book as a warning. I mean, I'm not a prophet. I'm not the son of a prophet. And I'm not one of these people who have an exact date for our expiration, like some of the climate change people do. You know, they keep setting these dates where America's going to blow up, the world's going to blow up, and when it doesn't happen, they change it to another date. I'm not like that. I'm just saying, look, there are certain signs, there are certain symptoms to diseases, and there are certain symptoms to the collapse of empires and nation states. And we better address some of these because there's no guarantee that America is going to last forever.
No.
It's not in Scripture. I looked it up before I talked to you.
No, you're right about that. You're absolutely. I mean, yeah, when you look at human history and you can go through all these different empires like Glubb did and you can make the comparisons and, you know, it's not that hard to figure it out that you can't outlast human nature and the effects of human nature when it gets to a certain point. One of the people you mentioned in the book, and I'm so glad that you did, is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And he's one of my favorites. I just love him. And I've read a lot of his speeches. But many people will remember him as the Gulag Archipelago author and the one who really tried to warn the West decades ago, you guys better get it together, because he had lived through the Soviet system and he knew what communism hath wrought. Yet here we are in the year 2020 embracing communism, or maybe we should just say at this point socialism, in so many quarters of American life. Why didn't we listen to Solzhenitsyn? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Solzhenitsyn's great line, and he had two major speeches, the one at Harvard, which the New York Times editorial page hated, and then the Templeton Prize for Religion. He also made a speech that, both of which are excerpted in my book. His greatest line was, he said, "I've been asked numerous times how communism could prevail for seven decades in the Soviet Union. And my answer is," or Russia, "my answer is," he said, "we forgot God."
Yes.
And I went back and looked up some of this. You know, Lincoln said the same thing. Lincoln said the cause of the Civil War was that we forgot God. We forgot the hand that graciously preserved us and turned only to ourselves. Moses warned against this, but Scriptures are loaded with references to what happens to individuals and nations that forget God. You know, I think of the wonderful Don McLean song, which I quote in the book at the end of the song called Vincent. They didn't listen. They're not listening still. Perhaps they never will.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, when you look at what is going on in the United States, we are not, you know, officially a Christian nation. We know that. But we know that without the Bible and the foundation of the Bible, there couldn't have been a United States because of all the biblical principles upon which this nation was built. Does our current state, though, have a lot to do with the health or lack thereof of the church?
Well, when you talk about the church, you know, Paul writes in Colossians that we are the church, individuals are the church, not a building, not a denomination, not the rest. And as I write in the book, the moral quality of a nation comes not from the top down, not from government, not from politicians, but from the bottom up. If you look at the great revivals that have hit America, there have been three of them. The most famous was the one in 1857. And it all began in what the historian J. Edwin Orr called a concert of prayer. Two men got together on Wall Street during their lunch hour and began to pray for revival. And they were joined by other men. And then in the little church they were meeting in, there wasn't enough room, so they moved it to the churches and invited their wives at night. And the revival exploded. At the height of it, 10,000 people were being converted every week in New York City alone. The revival jumped the Atlantic and went as far as the coal mines in Wales. And there was a work slowdown. And Orr asked the question, well, how could there be a work slowdown with a revival? And the response was, so many miners were converted, they stopped using bad language, and the horses couldn't understand what was being said to them. That was very funny. But this is what happens. And I think we've tried everything else. Paul writes in Romans 8, God has built futility into his creation in hope that the creation will turn to him.
Yes.
We've tried Republicans and Democrats, liberals, conservatives, spending more, spending less. Well, not so much spending less, but I dare say that in my years on this earth, there's nothing new under the sun that has not been tried. The only thing that hasn't been tried is God, and I think he should be the first resource, but he's the only one who can turn it around for us.
Oh, he is. I'm so glad that you mentioned J. Edwin Orr, because I was reading some of the history that he wrote about recently as well. And the period right after the American Revolution, there was a moral slump then, too. And you had churches in great decline. You had huge amounts of drunkenness, and everybody was kind of, you know, oh, boy, it's kind of over. But this should give us hope, right? Because when we see what the Lord has done in previous revivals, it can give us hope that if we will just humble ourselves and maybe initiate a new concert of prayer, that the Lord will be merciful yet again. And I think that's the hope we can still have in the midst of it all.
Absolutely, Janet. But it all begins. The prayer must be focused on glorifying God, not in improving ourselves or our 401ks or getting who we like in political office. Humbling ourselves means confessing our sin individually and nationally, and asking God to glorify himself through a revival. If one is to come, I think that is the only path.
I agree with you. That's excellent. Well, here's another angle on all of this. When you look at the Roman Empire, if memory serves me correctly on this, it wasn't just a matter of having external enemies. It was also a matter of having enemies within. And when you see everything that's going on in Washington right now, the resistance movement against Trump, just the progressive movement in general that says we don't like America as it was handed down to us. There is something fundamentally wrong. It was Obama wanting to fundamentally transform America. If you have people working inside your country to undo everything that made it great, apart from prayer, how do you write that? How could you write that?
Well, here's the key, Janet. You said apart from prayer. Prayer is the most powerful and the most fundamental thing we can do, and yet so many believers leave it to last. How many times have you heard, well, all I can do is pray?
Yes.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
All you can do is call on the creator of the universe, the one who knows every cell in your body, the one who cares about you more than anybody else. That's why he sent his son to die for you, so you would have access to him in heaven, the only perfect life ever to be lived on this earth, and we leave that to last. I think if we use that first, we'd see a lot better results, not only for ourselves, but in our nation.
Well, that's right. If there were to be a new concert of prayer, Cal, what do you think we should begin to pray for? What would be a priority just for beginning, oh, Lord, have mercy, but where should we start in begging him for mercy?
Well, glorifying himself. I mean, this is, you know, when Jesus prayed after he came up out of the water and the dove descended upon him, and the voice from heaven said, you know, I will glorify myself. I have glorified myself. I will glorify myself. Now, this is not an ego trip. This is why we were made. We were made in the image of God to glorify him, even in our fallen nature, even in our sinful state. Those who glorify him will find wonderful blessings, not only in their own life. The other thing is, in the ultimate church-state moment, when Jesus appeared before Pilate, and Pilate said, don't you realize I have the power of life and death over you? And he said, you wouldn't have that power if my Father hadn't given it to you.
Right.
And then Pilate says, well, you're a king then, right? And Jesus says, well, yeah, but my kingdom is not of this world. That is the most powerful statement ever made on church-state relations. This world is passing away, but the one to come is glorious. The tree of life was the first thing removed when our first parents sinned, and it will be the last thing restored when perfection is restored to the world.
Absolutely.
That gives us hope.
Absolutely. And as Christians, we need to keep in mind that ultimately eternity lies before us, and there are more important things than some of the minor political battles that we have. Souls are at stake, and our nation needs prayer now. Well, America's Expiration Date, great book by nationally syndicated columnist Cal Thomas. Always good to talk to you, Cal. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Janet.
All right. God bless you. We'll be back. This archived broadcast of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's your host, Janet Mefford.
Boy, did J. Christian Adams get it right at PJ Media. Trump at the March for Life seals the irrelevancy of the Never Trumpers. Boy, that has never been more true and more starkly seen than by what happened on Friday. What a day. That was unbelievable, wasn't it? President Trump standing up, the very first president in American history to join the March for Life and willingly put himself out there, not worrying about abortion protesters being seen in a picture with him or getting on a video with him. He just doesn't care. It was great. Let's get into it. I want to play some of it. I'm going to come back to the Never Trumper thing. Trust me. But I want you first to hear a little bit of what the president had to say. This is his opening statement.
It is my profound honor to be the first president in history to attend the March for Life. We're here for a very simple reason, to defend the right of every child, born and unborn, to fulfill their God-given potential. For 47 years, Americans of all backgrounds have traveled from across the country to stand for life. And today, as President of the United States, I am truly proud to stand with you.
Fantastic. And you know what's so great about this is now he has set a precedent for all future, not only Republican presidents, but all future presidents. If we ever get to a point where Democrats realize they've been wrong about this for 47 years, it will put pressure on every president until we see the day when Roe v. Wade is overturned. He goes on to discuss the impact of young pro-life activists, too. Listen to cut two.
I want to welcome tens of thousands. This is a tremendous turnout. Tens of thousands of high school and college students who took long bus rides to be here in our nation's capital. Young people are the heart of the March for Life, and it's your generation that is making America the pro-family, pro-life nation. The life movement is led by strong women, amazing faith leaders, and brave students who carry on the legacy of pioneers before us who fought to raise the conscience of our nation and uphold the rights of our citizens. You embrace mothers with care and compassion. You are powered by prayer and motivated by pure, unselfish love.
That's great. Then he also talked about the unborn children being a gift from God, which they certainly are. This is cut three.
All of us here today understand an eternal truth. Every child is a precious and sacred gift from God. Together, we must protect, cherish, and defend the dignity and the sanctity of every human life. When we see the image of a baby in the womb, we glimpse the majesty of God's creation. When we hold a newborn in our arms, we know the endless love that each child brings to a family. When we watch a child grow, we see the splendor that radiates from each human soul. One life changes the world. From my family, and I can tell you, I send love, and I send great, great love. And from the first day in office, I've taken a historic action to support America's families and to protect the unborn.
Well, this is absolutely right. So he does go into all that he has done to support the cause of the unborn. This is pretty great. Cut four.
Unborn children have never had a stronger defender in the White House. And as the Bible tells us, each person is wonderfully made. We have taken decisive action to protect the religious liberty. So important, religious liberty has been under attack all over the world and, frankly, very strongly attacked in our nation. You see it better than anyone, but we are stopping it. and we're taking care of doctors, nurses, teachers, and groups like the Little Sisters of the Poor. We are preserving faith-based adoption. And to uphold our founding documents, we have confirmed 187 federal judges who apply the Constitution as written, including two phenomenal Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh.
Now, considering that the whole issue of pro-life is an ethical issue, a moral issue, and considering that the president just made reference to everything he has done for religious liberty, don't you think that the head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest evangelical denomination in the United States, should be standing up and thanking and praising President Trump for doing exactly what this group claims that it is there to do? No, of course there was no praise for President Trump. I'm going to get into that in a little while, but we go back to Dr. Russell Moore going after Trump from the very beginning, calling him an arrogant huckster, saying that his campaign was all about pent-up nativism and bigotry all over the country, warning that he was what the founding fathers warned us about. And then eventually, you might recall that Trump tweeted back that he was a nasty man with no heart and a terrible representative of evangelicals. But why doesn't he just swallow his pride at this point and say, I picked a fight with a guy. I didn't want him to be president, but I got to give credit where credit is due. Good grief. You think if President Obama appeared at the March for Life as the first president to ever do so, that Russell Moore would have stayed silent and the ERLC would have ignored it? Not a chance. Let's go on to talk a little bit here from Trump about the Democrats' radicalism on abortion. Cut five.
When it comes to abortion, Democrats is a And you know this, you've seen what's happened. Democrats have embraced the most radical and extreme positions taken and seen in this country for years and decades, and you could even say for centuries. Nearly every top Democrat in Congress now supports taxpayer-funded abortion all the way up until the moment of birth. Last year, lawmakers in New York cheered with delight upon the passage of legislation that would allow a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb right up until delivery. Then we had the case of the Democrat governor in the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. And we love the Commonwealth of Virginia, but what is going on in Virginia? What is going on? The governor stated that he would execute a baby after birth. You remember that? Senate Democrats even blocked legislation that would give medical care to babies who survive attempted abortions. And that's why I've called on Congress. Two of our great senators here, so many of our congressmen here, and called upon them to defend the dignity of life and to pass legislation prohibiting late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in their mother's womb.
There just isn't any breathing room in between these two positions of being completely pro-life, doing everything you can to protect a baby in a mother's womb, passing all the legislation and issuing executive orders to give people the religious liberty, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, to not have to pay for abortion-inducing drugs, all the way to getting all these justices, the two justices on the Supreme Court and the judges throughout the judicial system in America to uphold the cause of life. And then on the other side, the Ralph Northams of the world in New York and Illinois passing those radical pro-abortion laws. There's not much in the middle anymore. You either have to choose the pro-life side or the radical pro-abortion side. How in the world can you be in the middle anymore? Because the politics of it is not allowing people to be in the middle. You got to choose one or the other. Isn't this a good time, though, for the Southern Baptist Convention to take the lead and to stand on the side of life? Or is it about the petty anger that somehow the never Trumper Russell Moore still holds for the president that makes him unable to get rid of that and say, hey, I was wrong. You know, I might not have voted for the guy. I might still have some problems with the guy, but I got to give credit where credit is due. Way to go, President Trump. I salute you. It would have been a good political move for him as well if he was really going to appeal to the millions of pro-life Southern Baptists. But unfortunately, didn't happen. We'll be coming back. Stay with us. How much is one life worth? Most of us would say life is priceless, and we'd be right. After all, what is the value of someone created in the image of God? We're asking Janet Mefford Today listeners, just like you, to help us save babies through the ministry of Preborn. How does Preborn save babies? Through ultrasounds. Preborn works with hundreds of pro-life pregnancy centers across America, providing free ultrasounds for women in crisis pregnancies. And 80% of the time, when a mother sees her little baby on an ultrasound, she'll choose life. It's that easy. We need your help to support the vital work of Preborn in saving human lives. For your gift of $28, you can provide a free ultrasound to a mom in a crisis pregnancy. And for a gift of $140, you can provide 5 ultrasounds to 5 mothers. All you have to do is call 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for saving a baby's life. The healthcare open enrollment period has ended. Did you miss it? Don't go a whole year without having a healthcare program. Sign up with Liberty HealthShare. As a Christian healthcare sharing ministry, Liberty HealthShare is not insurance, so you can still sign up. In fact, you can sign up any time of year, and there are no contracts. Starting as low as $199 a month, Liberty HealthShare has memberships for singles, couples, and families, so you can choose the ideal program for your situation. Plus, Liberty HealthShare has no network, so you're free to pick your own doctors, hospitals, and providers. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit ministry, so your money goes toward helping other members with their eligible medical expenses. And in your time of need, other members are there for you, too. You can feel good knowing you're part of a community of like-minded individuals who understand the importance of people coming together to bear one another's burdens. Go to libertyhealthshare.org/JMT for more information. libertyhealthshare.org/JMT.
You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's Janet.
Well, I salute and thank, and I do want to praise President Trump for showing up at the March for Life on Friday. I think he did a tremendous job. We've been playing some of the excerpts of what the president had to say. And for the life of me, I don't know why Dr. Russell Moore of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention and his ERLC staff could put pictures and videos up of themselves at the March for Life, seemingly patting themselves on the back, but they can't, you know, be big enough people to pat the president on the back a little bit. You know, this is why I was saying earlier that J. Christian Adams at PJ Media has it right, that Trump at the March for Life seals the irrelevancy of the Never Trumpers. And I think he's spot on about that. And he was writing this great article about how you really have such a stark reality going on now, where we had Bush at one time and George W. Bush was a pro-life president, but he wouldn't appear at the March for Life. And he says in this article, what became clear was that Never Trump Republicans looked even more ridiculous at the end of the March for Life than they did that morning. Trump was embraced by the largest gathering of pro-life Americans and Trump embraced them. Never Trump Republicans can't imagine a man like Trump attending the March for Life. Never Trumpism is built on a foundation of sanctimony. These sanctimonious few don't like how Trump speaks. They don't like his bombast. They don't like his past. He's not George Bush. He says, get over it. He's winning. That he is not George Bush might be Trump's greatest transgression to Never Trumpers. Much of the hatred is mercenary, as so many have suffered financially from the end of their consultancy gravy train. But Trump actually attended the March for Life. And you can't judge prevailing winds if you don't think that matters to the 100,000 plus people who marched. And he mentions satellite uplinking was what Bush chose to do. And he didn't necessarily want to be in a picture with someone who is a kooky abortion protester. And that says a lot about what he thought about the movement, or what some thought about the movement, he says. And he says, I'm a fan of George Bush. America's been blessed with presidents who are the right men for their time, like Bush. But the excuses don't ring true with the people who march, especially after Trump appeared. The slavish worship of the independent soccer mom has been rendered forever obsolete by the successful base-driven politics of Obama and now Trump. The middle is gone. And that also rattles the never-Trumpers. What's also striking about the never-Trumpers is how their hatred resembles a pathology, like some deep, raw childhood memory. Trump is their aunt's cat, who used to viciously scratch them each visit. Trump is the playground bully who threw the football at their face. Trump is the twisted cousin who made you look at his dead animals in jars hidden in the back shed. He's the boogeyman of their nightmares. It all wells up in them decades later in outbursts, fears, and rage. It's unhinged. Among the worst never-Trumpers are the sanctimonious pinhead academics, he says. They'll always have a reason in the corner of some treatise or textbook they wrote to prove Trump is Mussolini. They're at once laughable but also pathetic because their audience is mostly confined to captive students and fellow professors. And he goes on, it's just true. And he's talking about, you know, never Trumpers just don't understand the real world. When you're driving through parts of post-industrial America, you see Trump flags flying in suburban neighborhoods. You see the word Trump painted on the sides of buildings. And it's not like anything we've seen in our lifetimes. And what he's really trying to say here is the never Trumpers are completely missing the boat. And they're too arrogant, I would say, as in the case of certain leaders, to admit they were wrong. And that's the bottom line. If you're a Republican, as so many of these people who are never Trumpers claim to be, then why would you find Trump's policies objectionable? You know, I go to the ERLC website, for example, and they had one article about the March for Life written by Chelsea Patterson Sobolik from the ERLC. Pro-life is pro-woman. A look at the March for Life 2020. And here, buried in paragraph four, listen to how this is phrased. This year, for the first time in the country's history, the President of the United States addressed the March for Life in person. President Trump first addressed the march in January 2019 through a video simulcast from the White House Rose Garden. His remarks via technology built on previous precedent of pro-life presidents that included four addresses by phone from President Reagan in the 80s and an address from President Bush in the early 2000s. And then a couple sentences later, this year, President Trump joined the march on stage and delivered a speech about the importance of the pro-life policies and regulations his administration has prioritized. Pro-life advocates believe these in-person addresses by both the vice president and now president move the goalpost for actions that future pro-life administrations will be expected to take. High praise indeed. He delivered a speech. They're making me say this. I'm blinking in SOS as I am being forced to type this on my keyboard. And the distancing languages. Pro-life advocates believe these in-person addresses by both the vice president and the president move the goalposts for actions that pro-life administrations would be expected to make. Not only that, but they ran old articles. An old article by Russell Moore that he wrote in 2018. That's what he put on his Twitter feed. Nothing new, because if he had written a new article about the March for Life, he would have had to maybe praise the president. And so to get around that, maybe, or maybe he was just really, really, really busy writing about robots again and artificial intelligence, he didn't really even have anything to say at all. But he did put, you know, a picture of himself up on the ERLC Twitter feed. Yay for him. Let's praise him. Thank you. Oh, you're so pro-life. Oh, and then they had the Evangelicals for Life conference. You know, I've talked about that every year. Don't you know that Roe v. Wade was all about illegal aliens and refugees? And if you're not for illegal aliens and world relief getting more money to resettle refugees that aren't properly vetted, then you're not totally pro-life. You're not pro-life. No, you're not. Listen to this. This is from the ERLC Twitter feed. This was actually a quote from one of the speakers at the Evangelicals for Life 2020 conference. Okay, listen to this. This speaker said, when we make the pro-life agenda a political agenda, we alienate so many people, even many of our own brothers and sisters in the church. We must be more than that. Okay, first of all, to this I would say, you don't think that the pro-life issue needs to be a political issue? How else do you get laws passed? How else do you get pro-life politicians unless you make the pro-life cause a political issue? They're acting like politics is so evil when they don't think so at all. These people are all about politics. They're about liberal politics, first, last, and always. That's why they're trying to take Roe v. Wade and exploit it as being a pro-life issue. You got to be completely pro-life, the way that Ron Sider said back in 1987. Completely pro-life was his book, and I talked about this in my speech at the Stand Against Marxism conference. It's all repackaged leftism, and they're political to the hilt. But we can't be political about the pro-life issue because we'll alienate people. Let me tell you something. The only people who are alienated by a pro-life political agenda are pro-abortion progressives. And I couldn't care less if those people are alienated. They need to feel down to their core the fact that we have committed a genocide in this country against the unborn. I am through with this. I don't care if we alienate anybody in the church. They're the ones who need to repent if they're alienated by a pro-life political agenda. They ought to get on board with it if they're pro-life. And if they're not getting on board with it, that means they're not pro-life. And that's the problem, not whether or not the pro-life issue is a political issue. And if I sound upset, I am upset. I'm very upset because I'm tired of it. The Southern Baptist Convention has been such a solid, stalwart pro-life denomination for such a long time. There are so many millions of great pro-life Southern Baptists, and you've got the head of your Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission and his entire staff embarrassing you. I'm not saying that none of those people are pro-life. I'm not trying to go over the top with this. But what I'm saying is at the very moment when you could stand as a denomination behind the president and just say thank you, you don't have to back everything he does or says, but you could say thank you. And he can't even do it. And frankly, there's no surprise to me at all that you're seeing more and more Southern Baptists saying, I've just had enough of this stuff. You should have enough of this stuff. You deserve somebody better at the top of your ERLC. And maybe this will be a turning point. And by the way, it's all about the babies. It's all about the unborn. It's all about saving lives. That's why so many of you have been calling 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229. We are now at 152 babies who are going to have life because you are sponsoring free ultrasounds through the Ministry of Preborn. We have 98 babies to go. We want to save the lives of 250 babies. This is the last week. We really need you. If you could give a gift of $28, you'll be sponsoring one free ultrasound for an abortion-minded woman who walks into a pregnancy center. And it is life-changing because these women who have these free ultrasounds, 8 out of 10 of them will choose life. It's the most direct way we have or that we know of saving unborn babies. This is such a wonderful ministry. So many of you have been so generous. But could I ask you, if you've been listening to me, ask to really have your support right now and you haven't picked up the phone yet or gone online to janetmefford.com, please do so today. Please do so. We want to get to that magic number of 250 babies. Any gift will help. $28 sponsors one free ultrasound session. $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Any gift of any size will help, though. Just call now, 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229, 855-402-2229, or you can click on the preborn banner at janetmefford.com. We want to thank each and every one of you who have already done so. We are so grateful to God for you. You guys are standing in the gap for the next generation of life, and God sees what you're doing and will bless you for it because this is what it's all about. Those little precious babies in the womb. They matter to God, and so they should matter to us. 855-402-2229 is the number, and thanks again. All right, we've got to end it now, but thank you for tuning in to Janet Mefford today. We always appreciate you tuning in. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.